So beginning a new day. This is this day today is a new day. It's a new moment, establishing ourselves again in this present moment. And here and now, in each moment, practicing establishing our capacity for attention, for receptivity, for inquiry. It's also a beautiful day this morning, and it's the day that we finish our retreat together. So learning to, through this retreat, been learning, practicing this capacity for awareness, also for this inner listening, another way of talking about awareness, listening into the heart, reflecting, listening beyond our assumptions and our views and our ideas and our opinions, to contemplate the unfolding of our being, our body, our lives, from this knowing that in a way is open and unknowing. We don't really know what's going to happen. There's a lot of unknownness, and rather than defending ourselves against that by trying to control everything or moving on to the next thing through our thoughts where we feel we'll find security, or establishing ourselves in memory, which gives us a sense of designation in time and space. In the practice of meditation, we allow ourselves to just rest in the unknownness of life, the uncertainty, to recognize the reality of that. We don't know what the future will bring. Learning to establish presence without grasping the future, to find certainty, without dwelling in the past, to find security, and more subtly, without even attaching to this present moment. But allowing the forms to arise and pass, and finding our stability in this capacity for awareness, which is a place of knowing, it's a place of brightness, a place of wisdom, a place of connectedness. Connectedness with this moment, this breath, this being, this flow of life. Very first Dhamma talk that I heard was from one of the very first Dhamma talks that I heard was from Ajahn Chah. And when he came to the UK, came to Oxford, and at the time I was doing a retreat, and we left the retreat to go and listen with the students to hear his Dhamma talk. And listening to Ajahn Chah, even though he was speaking Thai and it was being translated, was very profound for me. As I was listening, I just felt how much truth he was speaking. I don't even remember what he was saying, but it was a very beautiful experience to be in his presence and to hear him reflecting on the Dhamma. So through the talk, I was just thinking how good it was to hear him, good it was to be nourished by this Dhamma. And then at the end of the talk, he said, if you've been listening to this talk and you've been sitting here thinking it's good or it's bad, you haven't been listening properly. And I thought, well, that's really good. So this sounds quite an offhand comment that Ajahn Chah made, but there's something very profound about it. How do we listen? Can we listen to life, to our being, to ourselves, to each moment, beyond the assumptions and the way we just react to the appearance of our experience? Oh, it's just like this, it's another morning, it's me, it's my breath, it's boring, what's next? So in this capacity for meditation, we're learning to really listen more deeply to each moment. This is something that we don't only do on our cushion in a meditation retreat, but that we take into our everyday lives. In each moment we can inquire, how is it now? What's present? Steady our hearts, steady our mind with the breath, with the body. So I hope that something of what we do in these retreats we can take out into our everyday lives. We can irrigate our everyday lives with what we've been practicing here, what we've been cultivating. The Buddhist path isn't just a one-fold path, just sit and that's it. It's an eightfold path. So it talks to how we speak, how we act, the intentions of the mind, what we do in our lives. How to take this mindfulness, this awareness, this reflectiveness, this inner listening, this contemplation, and allow it to inform all aspects of our lives. This retreat, we've been cultivating this capacity for samasamadhi, moments of gatheredness, moments of reflection, based on the five jhana factors, the ability to come into, to direct the thought rather than just having the thoughts run away with us, create mansions of hope and fear and fantasy and anxiety. We train the thinking process to direct the attention to here and now. This is something we can do in any moment, whether we're in the office, whether we're with our family, whether we're driving, in the middle of a conversation. We can always ask the question, how is it now? What's present here and now? Rather than looking to see, is it perfect for me? Are the right conditions? How is it here and now, coming to the breath, to the body, to sound, to steady the mind here and now? So directing the attention and then receiving what's present and allowing what we receive to be contemplated. So as we explore this capacity for gatheredness, something that we can do to help, just I find it very helpful in my everyday life, just to remember a sense of capacity for inner well-being that I can access, which is less dependent upon the circumstances. Very easy to get stressed, to get overwhelmed, to get anxious, particularly in the intensity of our contemporary life. So many very large issues. It's easy then to react and get stimulated with fear, with worry. Just being able to steady the heart and to know a place of inner well-being, to breathe, to connect with our awareness, and then allowing also for us to investigate, bringing that attention, that awareness, to reflect on what's actually happening here and now. What am I creating, and what is the actuality? This feeling, there's sensation, there's breath, there's movement. And this is the world of change. All things are changing and moving. And allowing our reflection on that to inform our wisdom. Where am I grasping? Where am I generating suffering? Wishing that it was different than what it is. Am I trying to make life perfect for me? Trying to make myself perfect, others perfect, right, stable, secure, so I won't feel this stress? Because if we're under that delusion, then it's a very long road. It's never finished. We never get there. We never get it. We have moments, and then it, beyond our control, shifts and change. So this inner wisdom allows us to recognize just how to let it be, how to let the flow of life be, and to let go of our demand that this world makes us happy. The happiness isn't going to be, we have momentary happiness with this world. It's lovely when things go right, enjoy our friendships, enjoy the beauty that's here. But ultimately, this inner happiness that the Buddha pointed to wells up from our wisdom, our capacity for insight, for well-being. So this demand that someone else makes me happy, or this world gives me what I think I need, is a fragile assumption upon which to base our well-being. So when we begin to sense this possibility of a way of being in life more informed by wisdom, by inner steadiness of heart, then we can hold things more lightly. We don't have to milk every moment for what we feel we need. We can hold it more lightly, and the irony of that, as we do that, we can, in the simple things, rather than the huge experiences and extreme experiences, in the simple unfolding of our life, there can be a lot of joy, a lot of beauty, a lot of miracles, just actually the miracle of breathing, the miracle of seeing the sunrise, the sunset, the beauty of seeing the vastness of the stars, the loveliness of sharing tea with a friend, the extraordinary thing of just being alive, just being here. This already is something of a great gift. So being able to live with wisdom means that we live with a heart that lets go and appreciates what's here. There's a lovely quote from Ananda Mahima, who is a saint, a contemporary saint in India, who lived, I think she died in the 1980s, she lived very recent times. I don't know if you've come across her teachings at all, but she really didn't teach actually, and she just appeared. She was born, and she grew up in Bengal. Led a very simple life as a Bengali housewife, but she had this unusual phenomena of seemingly was already fairly enlightened when she was young, as she grew up, and radiated throughout her whole life this sense of divinity. And towards the later in her life, people would just gather around her and she would just, you know, come and sit in her presence. Her presence was so wonderful. And as I said, she didn't really give formal teachings. She was the teaching. Her being was the Dhamma. So anyway, she is interesting, some of the things that she would say. What a being from that rooted so deeply in their awakening, how do they understand life? What is their relationship? When they're not struggling to try and awaken or be wise, they just are. So one of the questions she was once asked was, who are you? You know? And this was her... this was her response. She said, this body has lived with father, mother, husband, and all. It has served a husband so you may call it a wife. It has prepared food so you could call it a cook. It has done all sorts of tasks so you could call it a servant. But I consider it has served none other than God. When I look at others, I see them as manifestations of the divine and serve them as such. When I sat down to prepare food, I did it as if it were a ritual, for the food cooked was meant for God. When I look at others, I see them as manifestations of the divine and serve them as such. Whatever I did in the spirit of divine service. Hence, I was not quite worldly, though I was always involved in household affairs. I had but one ideal, to serve God. So here in this statement, you can hear this being coming from this... awakened place that's using the form of her life. She's not trying to get it perfect, find the perfect thing. The form of her life is to be a housewife, to be married as a Bengali in that culture, in that situation. But she used it, she was able to use it to see the way through the form to the formless. To use our lives, the stuff of our lives, however that comes to us, to see that each part of our lives can be used as a way of service, as a way of offering into, as a way of offering through, so that we can have the form of our life as a vehicle for our awakening, rather than it being something in spite of our awakening. I find this very helpful. One of the things that the Buddha said after his awakening was that those who have nothing to serve live unhappily. That if we don't have anything to serve, then we don't really have this deeper connectedness with the flow of life. We don't really feel the joy or the happiness that's possible when we're in relationship through this sense of offering into something that's larger than ourselves. You know, the Buddha himself even noticed this, that without anything greater than ourselves to serve, then it's not a very happy life. We just live for me, you know, for getting stuff for me. So then the Buddha considered, well, you know, what can I serve? You know, it's like a Buddha. What does, you know, he doesn't become, you know, a cleaner in someone's house. You know, what can I serve as a Buddha? This is an interesting question that he posed himself after his awakening. What do I serve? And then he reflected and said, I for me, for Buddha, I serve the Dhamma. I serve the law. The lawfulness of the Dhamma. And, you know, what is the Dhamma? All things. There's nothing apart from the Dhamma. So this sense of being in life with this attitude of offering, connecting, serving, compassion, whatever our Dhamma is, whether it's our work, whether it's cultivating our garden, whether it's our aspiration, whatever the Dhamma is for us, putting ourselves in relationship to it as offering into serving, doing our thing with this heart that can also let go in the midst of our activities, something that brings happiness, brings fulfillment. The Tao Te Ching says, this is a quote that I find very useful to reflect on, because it's, you know, the place that we serve from is not so much the agenda of how it should be, but more this emptiness, being able to listen, to let go, to listen into what's the right response in each moment. In Tao Te Ching, it says, it is easier to carry an empty cup than one that's filled to the brim. The sharper the knife, the easier it is to dull. The more wealth you possess, the harder it is to protect. Pride brings its own trouble. When you have accomplished your goal, simply walk away. This is the pathway of heaven. There's a teaching in Buddhist practice which is about accomplishing goals. Sometimes we can, when we hear the teaching, it sounds like we just, letting go means that we don't actually work with our lives in a way to bring about success. It sounds like we just have to, you know, be open and accept whatever flows, and we can't shape our life, we can't be active in our life, we can't guide our life. And it's not, that's one teaching that particularly we've emphasized is a lot about just letting go and being able to have a heart that can release. But also, as we go into our lives, as we pick up the stuff of our lives, our work, our relationships, our aspirations, it's useful, this teaching is very useful to help guide how we can manifest. This teaching is called the Iddhipada, the pathways to success, the pathway to fulfillment. The first quality or the first energy that we need to fulfill anything, any aspiration, whether it's a spiritual path, whether it's a worldly path, is this quality called chanda, which means aspiration, enthusiasm, which is the desire energy that we've been reflecting on, that's informed by compassion, by wisdom, by steadiness, by mindfulness, that's transformed and then used to help guide our energy. Where is our passion? Where is our interest? This is important for us to know. So we don't, you know, as practitioners, as Dharma practitioners, the idea is not just to become a sort of a limp cabbage and just sit in the field and allow things to happen. It is to activate and to guide our energies informed by these principles. So this first one, chanda, is a sense of where is my interest, my enthusiasm, my aspiration. Because where that is where we find our energy. This is the second quality, to fulfill, to bring about success in anything that we apply ourselves to, whether it's studies, whether it's bringing up a family, whether it's a business, whether it's a meditation practice. we need to be able to have a quality of energy that sustains through the ups and downs, through the pitfalls, through the inspiration and the lack of inspiration. So the energy to have our interest, which is connected with our energy body, to be able to cultivate an energy that can sustain something. It's not just driven and then collapse, but can sustain something through its birth, its manifestation, and to its fruition. The heart of that energy is based in this capacity. Once we've aligned ourselves with the sense of our aspiration, for example, to do a retreat, we aspire, we come into the retreat to sustain ourselves through a whole retreat, takes energy. The moments for all of us where one can feel like, oh, you know, just want to go. It's too difficult, I just want to bail out of here. So we have to hear those voices and still stay with something to go through the ups and downs. So it's helpful as we have moments of steadying our energy in mindfulness, in present moment awareness, to support our aspiration, to connect it with this third quality, which is called heart or citta, so that the heart is unified with our activity. And our activity, our heart, is connected not only with our own aspiration, but a sense of relationship to the whole. And this is this sense of service. If we're doing something and we aspire to something and we want to bring something to success, to fruition, if it's connected with a larger sense of heart, with wholeness, with connectionness, with relationship, it tends to be more fulfilling for us. For example, if I'm a business person and I have a lot of power, I'm able to have a lot of energy to fulfill my aspiration, but I don't have much heart in what I'm doing, I can't really sense how to enjoy the fruits of what I'm doing in each moment. I can't unify in each moment around, can't stay steady around what is present here and now in the process of doing it. I can't connect with the sense of service, with the sense of whole, then I can get very successful, get a lot of money, get power, but the heart can be very diminished, doesn't necessarily enjoy, doesn't get nourished by its success. So these three qualities of aspiration transform desire, chanda, to use the energy, the passion of that in a skillful way, not in a unilluminated, driven, mindless way, but to see that we have energy as human beings. We have the potential to bring about fruition of skillful activity, directing that energy, guiding it by the heart, and then this fourth factor of the Iddhipada, the pathways, roadways to success, is called Vimungsa, which means discernment. To be able to reflect, how's this going? It's feedback. How's it going? Is this working? Do I need to let go more? Do I need to apply more energy? Do I need to bring more heart? Am I on the wrong road, actually? Do I need to adjust my effort, to relax more, to take time out? So someone that has a lot of vimungsa a lot of discernment. Sometimes if we're, all of these qualities we bring into balance to bring about fruition of something that we've applied ourselves to bring success. If we have an imbalance, then we can have a lot of discernment, thinking about how this is going, is it going well, is it not. We can actually, if we don't have any heart, any enthusiasm, we can think ourselves out of everything. That's an imbalance, isn't it? We don't actually risk anything. We just sit there and think about all the shortcomings. If we just have a sense of enthusiasm and it's not guided, then we might just go hurtling off in the wrong direction. There's no discernment, there's no balance, no checking. If we have discernment, energy, enthusiasm, but no heart, we might get to where we want to go, but we've left our heart out of it. Our capacity, ultimately, to actually enjoy the process of it, because we're not able to be present in each moment. So as we go into our lives from the retreat, as we make the transition very shortly from this stillness, from this quite controlled environment, we're going to begin to negotiate what our lives are. We go home. You might go home, you know, full of wanting to share our experience, and no one's very interested. Yeah? So, you know, we have to adjust. Sometimes our Dhamma, remember when I was here as a young nun, I'd want to try and enlighten my family all the time. They didn't want to be enlightened. Quite happy as they were. And so, you know, eventually you kind of get less kind of missionary about it all. And just realize that actually it's much nicer just to harmonize with people and just to make friends and be with, you know, just to make the contact where we can, rather than expecting that we holding this idealization of where everyone else should be to meet, you know, to meet me. So as we go into our lives, to consider that, yes, we do practice to steady the heart. We do practice to be in life with a heart that can let go, let be, to taste peace in any moment. But we also are able to respond, to pick up, to explore, to bring to fruition that which we have the capacity to do, to improve and to bring about healing and compassion in any way that we can into our lives, into the world around us. This is not something that's outside of the Buddha's teaching to be successful. But successful, what is success? To be successful, to bring to fruition whatever we're approaching in a way where we allow it to be a vehicle rather than an end in itself, a vehicle for our service, for our awakening, for our mindfulness, for our awareness, for the to be able to taste, is that quote of Ananda Mahima, that ultimately within this activity we're returning it all back to the Dhamma. We don't own it. So even the Buddha, I mean, the Buddha went after his awakening, and he sat under the Bodhi tree, and he thought, God, you know, he probably didn't think that, but he thought, this insight, what he saw is too subtle to teach. You know, I had a huge resistance. I can't teach this. No one will understand. It's. I guess he just thought, I just go off to the Himalayas, which was the tradition, and live in a cave and just radiate loving kindness and not engage the world. The world's too difficult. No one will understand me. It's kind of what you can feel sometimes as a meditator. It's like, God, you know, this is a bit difficult to translate all of this into the hurdy-burdy of life. So in his own way, the Buddha had something of that kind of a sense. You know, the journey of the Buddha, however we understand it, it's an archetypal journey. So as an archetype, it also applies to us. You know, all the stages of his process were something that we also live through if we open ourselves to that way. So he's just thought, no, this is too difficult. And so he was a reluctant teacher, that's for sure. But it's said that the great god Brahma Sahampati came down from the Brahma realms. This angelic being appeared before the Buddha and said, you know, please, for those with a little dust in their eyes, there will be those that can understand. And for those beings with a little dust in their eyes, please go forth and teach the Dhamma. So this Brahma Sahampati symbolizes the movement of compassion. This is ultimately the bodhicitta, the compassion, that which motivates us to respond. And the Buddha sustained, I mean, talk about sustaining something, energy, through 40 odd years of teaching, and brought about fruition. You know, he didn't just sort of half-heartedly apply himself in life. He managed to set up an order, a teaching, a way of practice that sustained itself through time and space. That was a huge undertaking in the face of challenge to the tradition of the day, the authorities, the religious authorities, challenged by jealous disciples, being nearly killed, sickness, people getting the teachings wrong, criticism, sickness, you know, just all the things that can face us. So as we leave this retreat, just all of these practices, words, teachings, we'll probably forget them all. But that's okay. I've listened to thousands of Dhamma talks, and sometimes I just think I don't know anything. Years and years. And it's really not necessarily about remembering all the forms and the phrases and how it was put, but it's really having confidence ultimately in empowering ourselves to realize and taste our own capacity for freedom, the heart's innate. It's not that the heart needs to attain freedom, it is free. The mind, the heart in its natural state, is already free. Vimutti sarasabe dhamma. In the heart of all moments, all conditions, there's already spaciousness. Freedom. We're just really needing to turn to that, to realize that. So hopefully, rather than this sense of being taught, hopefully something in this retreat can empower you to really trust your own intuitive awareness. The way ultimately isn't defined by forms and methods, suttas, teachings, teachers, traditions. The way is informed, ultimately our connection with the way is ultimately through our intuitive awareness of the heart. It's accessible to us in each moment as we steady ourselves and listen. Listen into how it is now, listen into our being, listen to our breath, listen to this miracle, this mystery of life. And as the poet Rilke said, not to be in a hurry to answer all our questions. That our questions are there to be lived, not necessarily answered. On behalf of Kirisara and myself, I realized that when we first came to this retreat that probably some of you we hadn't really met, we haven't met some of you we've met before, some of you we haven't met, and there's something a bit odd about sitting here and doing this and you sitting there thinking, who are these guys? Where we live in South Africa, in the middle of the Zulu kingdom, the African tradition is that you would introduce yourselves, and not only yourselves, but your ancestors and who you are. And so there's a context for the relationship, and it's considered impolite not to do that. And there's a lot of ceremony around just that. Just acknowledging. We haven't really done that so much, and hopefully through our days together we have got a sense of knowing each other a bit more. But this is Kirisara. So I realise someone's like, which one is Kirisara? Which one's Kirisara? I think God knows. So this is Kirisara. It comes from the Sanskrit, also Kirti, which means honor, like Kirtan. The Hindu song, Kirtan? Kitty, Kirti. So Kitty means honor. And Saro is this word, essence. So worthy of honor. Kitty Saro, as you've gathered, he's from America. That's what you heard. Chattanooga, Tennessee, which is another world. And I'm Tan Isra. Tan means foundation, and Isra is Ishvara, means the Thai translation of that is freedom, but it also is Ishvara means creator. So I create a lot. So my name, my Buddhist name means foundation and freedom. And my background is, I was born in London, and from Irish Catholic family, and English Protestant mother, lots of complexity. We were brought up in an extended Irish Catholic context, but because of my English Protestant grandmother, I had to be baptized in both churches. So I figured out the best way to resolve that was to become a Buddhist. And we have, as you've gathered, we both spent time with the teacher of Ajahn Chah and in the monastic school that he was part of, a revivalist movement of the forest school. As I said the other day, the Buddhist tradition goes through these revivalist movement. The forest monastic school was a revivalist movement back to simplicity after the essence of the lifestyle being lost a little bit through becoming overly ritualized. And so this was a movement back to living as closely to how the Buddha originally set up the order, the principles of mendicancy, tudong, which means walking through life without attachment, and community, a lot of emphasis on community. Both Kisa and I involve in the early movement of that school from northeast Thailand to the UK in the 70s and 80s. We've known each other for many years since that time. We've been with friends. We didn't think we'd land up getting married, but there we go. Life is full of surprises. We did eventually, something happened, some kind of chemistry somewhere along the line, and we did both, you know, the flow of our lives took us out of the monastery and we got married in 91, so 92 it will take a year. Yeah, so there it is. And we started to think, well, what the hell do we do now? So we started to receive invitations to teach. And that's basically what we've been doing, is continuing our practice and teaching. And then we were invited in 94 during the political transition in South Africa to help a Buddhist center there. And so we went down there and we got involved, quite deeply involved. We've been working there in South Africa for 12, 13 years now, while still keeping our connections with the Buddhist scene in the UK and in America. So we've been stretching ourselves geographically. And then more recently, we have both been to Israel previous to meeting up with the Buddhist community. And